So the subject for tonight's talk is the feely-feely practice, just to tease your intellect just a little. So as many of you are aware that, say like, especially when it comes to the Buddhist teaching, that every single one of us need, say like a minimum level of, say like knowledge, like background knowledge. You need to have an overview of the map and the directions, which way that you need to go with, say the Buddhist teaching. And the reason why people need that map or directions is because the path in itself, the nature of the human mind is a very complicated, changeable, almost a very, very, very tricky kind of, say, phenomena or experience. And especially the monastics, we go through so many different moods and mind states and reactions and, just different stuff, just day after day after day. And, the underlying forces and energies in the, say, the personality are, like almost endless, if you're looking at 30, 40, 50 years. And so each individual needs a very, very clear sense of direction, where, which way to go, because you can't necessarily, especially at the, say, the beginning to the intermediate stage, that you really can't trust oneself completely. You really have to constantly keep one's focus, one's attention on what the Buddha laid down as far as the development of the path, because with the monastics and the lay disciples, you can think and feel almost anything, you like. Every man and his dog has an opinion on almost anything. So, and people may feel that their particular perspective on life is right and true. What I think and what I feel is closer to reality than what you think or what you feel, because the human experience and any being in samsara, whether it's from a low to a high rebirth, you it's very difficult for you to think outside the box unless you've got your, say, your wisdom and insight faculty, I mean, really firmly established, where you have this very spacious, all-encompassing, very broad mind, which can essentially, it can see and understand things from many, many different directions. Because when you look at your personal experience as you walk the path, you can have like a dozen different reactions to the same experience from one day to the next. It all depends what mood you're in, or what karma you've got coming up between you and other people. And this karma that you have, both in this life and potentially tens or even hundreds of past lifetimes, but usually say like at a guess, the last 10 lifetimes and especially the previous birth, and roughly maybe the last 10 lifetimes would have maybe a significant effect on one's personal experience. But you've really got to have incredible, say, psychic ability, like supernormal, to really know something like that accurately. The average clairvoyant, or even potentially even regressionist, unless they're absolutely outstanding, the absolute cream of the crop. There's no way there's no way the average person could possibly know those things. Because of the depth, you're looking at a time scale and the depth and very, very precise events, times, places, and people. You've really got to have an understanding of the way karma actually works in the minds of people between themselves and others. So, why do I put this emphasis on say like feeling, on awareness, and even say like emotional intelligence? Because in essence, that you have to rely on your emotional experience, this feely-feely experience with the path, in order to really process and assimilate and sort of make sense of what you are going through with your personal experience. And naturally, human emotions are very, very complicated and broad-ranging, and there's probably thousands. There's almost a feeling for almost any experience you can possibly imagine. I wouldn't be surprised if you could have, oh, easily tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of different emotional responses connected with any kind of sense experience that a human being or any being can have in samsara, in this very, very, what would you call it, say, incredibly broad and expansive cycle of karma and rebirth. So why do I put so much emphasis on emotion when it comes to the say like the absorption and the understanding of the Buddhist teaching? And but so in essence, that you really can't understand anything, really. You won't be able to process your experience very, very clearly, or very, very intuitively, even on like an emotional sensitivity level, without actually feeling what you go through in any particular moment on any day, of the week. Because without emotion, you just don't have the data. You don't, without emotion, you don't have the sense data, the sensory data, which is giving you feedback, information. It gives you what's happening between you and other people. The kind of views and opinions and attitudes that you have, and the kind of karma that you have with other people. You have to, in essence, you have to feel as a human being, as any being, Devaloka, maybe, I mean, Brahmaloka, you're looking at like a mind-only experience, so it's going to be much, much more refined and subtle, the emotions that they have. But the Brahmaloka beings are still affected by feelings of power and authority, and potentially even things like even like jealousy. They talk about, say, like jealousy, what the jealousy of the Christian God, and they associate certain human feelings with the creator God of the Christian faith. But it's very, very hard to to get one's mind around the true experience of these say Brahma Loka beings, because if the mind on even on an say like a very refined emotional level, if the mind regresses to say like to an extensive extent, say like Devalokas, if you have a situation in the Devaloka realms, and this is mentioned in the sutras, where if the mind of a deva being is overcome by very unwholesome state of mind, that can easily shorten the lifespan of that deva being, shorten, like affect the personal happiness and the way they perceive, these happy, joyful, beautiful worlds that they live in, and it can even potentially bring them to fall from those worlds, because the state of consciousness which was responsible for to elevate them to that high level of rebirth in the first place is no longer present. As human beings that we can one day we can be in heaven. Say for example, when a person is absolutely in love with another person, that you're looking at a really exalted state of human emotion, and it may be the ultimate emotion for most people. And then you compare that with when you feel incredibly low and depressed, and you feel like your world is just falling apart, and so there's an incredible tangible like difference, the way you feel these experiences, so you can go like from heaven to hell, so as a human being. But the thing is that all these emotions that you go through, they are your teachers, and one can easily be misled or beguiled or tricked or deceived by one's feelings. I mean, very, very easily. People can become deluded, without sort of like great difficulty. The way one sees other people, the way one sees oneself, can just change very, very quickly. So how do we manage to maintain a like a fairly sort of clear sort of accurate perspective on what we are going through, how as an emotional based being in this universe, how can we possibly perceive our experience, say like in accordance with or in accordance to or as close to reality as we possibly can? And it's not necessarily an easy thing to do, because your personality is going to distort and bend and twist the sensory data which is coming in to one's mind through the five senses. And in essence, that's all you've got to rely on. For the vast majority of the population, cannot think and feel outside the box. You can't really sense and perceive outside of your personality. That's all, in essence, that's all you've got. You can't see through the eyes of another person, no matter what you might think. You know, some people say things like, oh, like, you know, like I really, you know, understand how you feel, and you know, that's exactly what I went through myself. And but it's not, there's no way in the world that you can really understand what another person is going through, because you don't have their personality at all. You've only got your personality with your sense world to you know, to rely on. And we're constantly working with delusion on a regular basis. But what happens over time, as we go through all these different emotions, all these different moods, different reactions, different sense contacts with people, situations with stress, with problems and difficulties, you're going through so much stuff that you start to get a more tangible feel for where people are at. You will never be able to know exactly how another person feels, regardless of how close or how tight you are with that person. You will never, ever, ever really understand how they feel, because you're not inside their mind. You know, you only know your own feelings. As you know, you cannot know another person's feelings and emotions at a very, very precise level, unless they actually sit you down. This is as close as you can get. You can sense what people feel to a degree. You can feel their vibrations. And you can feel emotions, even because monks can be quite sensitive people. Sometimes you can feel, and married couples, boyfriend, girlfriend, people who are very, very close can sometimes feel the emotional vibrations coming off the person they're associating with. And and if you get that person to sit down, you know, and explain exactly what they are going through, well, then, you know, you're going to have a much, much, you're going to have a far greater sense of clarity to where that, you know, where that actually, where that person, you know, where that person is at, you know, exactly what they, oh, actually, that's wrong. It'll give you a much better sense of what that person is going to, because it's not just the sense vibration, the emotional feeling that they're giving you, but it's, you know, they're actually, you know, they're actually trying to convey that in language, in your native language. And then, you know, because if they feel that you don't understand them at all, that, you know, if they sit you down and they spend several minutes or 5 minutes, you know, going through exactly why they, you know, the kind of reaction or the experience or this or that, then you get a better sense for where people are at. So we get this kind of, when it comes to, say, like emotional experience, the more stuff you go through in this practice will give you a better sense, will give you, say, like more data, more sort of raw material to process, to contemplate, to get a feel for where people, you know, where people are at in their practice, and you know, the kind of views and opinions, and you know, even people's like knowledge. So I was talking with a gentleman the other day who had very, very strong interest in say like ancient history, and it wasn't just the time and the place and the people. and the detail, but he had this very strong, like, emotional fascination and interest, as we were talking, and he was telling me about different events in history, and this guy's, you know, like a bit of an expert, and you could feel the richness. Sounds a bit funny, but you could feel the richness of his emotion coming through with the 1001 details that he was giving me. So, but in essence, that when it comes to, say, the Buddhist teaching, and when it comes to your emotional experience, every single feeling that you go through is going to bring you some understanding or some information. It's like a little piece in a massive jigsaw puzzle. You know, it's something which you're, you know, like, I wouldn't say like a drop of water in a bucket, but it's adding to what you know, what you understand, because, you know, experience, personal experience, you know, can be the greatest teacher for most people. Because if you don't, say for example, you've got someone who has never traveled, you know, you can't expect that person to have an understanding of other cultures, of other traditions, it could be anything, like primitive tribal folklore. You know, if you've never studied, you've never traveled, you know, how can you possibly have any understanding or say like a sense for these kind of events, this kind of human experience in history. So the emotional content of your life, you know, say for better or worse, you know, it's bringing you understanding, you know, it's bringing you knowledge and information, and these, you know, these emotions are the raw material for your insight practice. And so, you know, some people, they may feel that say for example, you've gone through a certain mood or emotion, you know, for the 100th time, or it could be the 1000th time over, you know, like 20, 30, 40 years. And the reason why, or one of the reasons why you keep getting triggered, why you keep reacting in the same way again and again and again, to your amazement, is that you really haven't fully understood, you know, who you are with that particular experience. If you say for example, somebody had a potential for, say, like for possessiveness, you know, they were a very, very possessive person, you know, and you get your, you know, with one's partner, one's children, you know, you just keep getting your fingers burnt again and again and again and again, you know, over years and years, 20, 30, 40 years. And the reason why this experience, why this thing keeps coming up, why you keep reacting in the same way again and again and again, is because you haven't fully understood the nature, the cause and effect, and the process of that thing, that experience, that mind emotional based experience. You really don't understand this thing from start to finish, because if you did, you'd be able to you don't be able to let that thing go. I mean, you know, in within seconds, you know, it would barely make, say, like an impact. You know, within two or three seconds, you've already seen the thing rise. You can see it coming, and you're able to basically, through understanding, you're able to just drop this thing very, very quickly, because you know, you already understand that this thing is painful. It's dukkha, as the Buddha explained in the Four Noble Truths. So if you grab hold of things, of objects, of people, of experiences, or you push these things away, so as soon as your mind moves with intention, you grab hold, or you grab hold, say, of the pleasant, or you push away that which is painful, which is distasteful, you know, the stuff you don't like in one's life, because the majority of this stuff relates to whether you like or dislike what you are going through. So if something triggers in a broad sense, if something makes you feel good, you tend to grab hold and cling and attach. But when you have say distaste or repulsion, grasping also takes place. That process of grasping takes place both for good feelings and bad, but it's the way it makes you feel. So, you know, say for example, just in the last couple of weeks, we've had basically young men, you know, quite butch, solid young guys having their hearts ripped out by girlfriends who've left them or abandoned them or run off with another guy, which is not funny because it's, you know, it's very, very painful. It could just go on for weeks or months. And, you know for a fact it's painful, it hurts. You know, you're a Buddhist practitioner. You know, the Buddha made it very clear, you know, this is dukkha, this is not to be clung to, this is not to be held on to and attached to, because, you know, it's suffering. It's, you know, it's painful. But because we, within our minds are quite deep and they're very, very fast, you know, you're looking at, you know, microseconds. You could be looking at hundredths parts of a second, the way this process takes hold of you, and you're subjected to absolute elation. You know, you're walking on air, or you're in a pit of misery, and you basically want to take one's life, or maybe even the lives of other people. So, but in essence, the bottom line is that one needs to really understand to a very deep and profound level what you are going through emotionally, and you have to, you know, where you are stuck. You know, as soon as you this is very, very different for people who live in the world. You know, the practitioners, the lay disciples, in general society, you know, it's a different ball game to the monastics. With the monastics in community, that's something that we have to basically work on again and again and again and again, because, you know, in essence, you know, essentially we want to reduce this level of, say, ignorance and delusion and lack of clarity. You know, the monks and nuns are expected to be reasonably peaceful, reasonably insightful, reasonably, say, behaved, well-mannered, decorum, all the rest, the whole business with the Buddhist training for the monks and nuns. So with us, we actually really have to focus at that point, where one is stuck. So if one, say for example, the monks and nuns, if we love someone or we hate a particular person on any particular day, it's our responsibility to ask oneself, why do I feel this way about this person? Because if you don't, this experience is going to go on for another 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And when you're living in community, you can only sort of be slapped in the face just so many times over and over and over again before you realize that you've really got to get onto this, and you've got to focus right at that point where you are stuck. But the kind of say ball game the monastics have to follow is not the same as the disciples in general society, whose relationships are very important to them, family, children, friends. You guys are, you're working, hopefully many of you are working full time with this whole COVID fiasco. And your worldly life, your worldly experience is quite important to you. I mean, otherwise you wouldn't necessarily want to be out there. Like myself, I don't like lay life at all, and I would never, ever, ever want to go back to it, although I could very, very easily. But I have absolutely no interest in lay life. I don't want to be caught in general society with the noise and the traffic and having to work for a living and all the thousand and one things that the people in general society have to do. I mean, but it's just a matter of context. What's important to me is not necessarily important at all to the rest of the population. So each individual, regardless of gender or status or responsibility, whatever position they have in general society, the vast majority of people, they want their life to be meaningful. They want, the vast majority of people, want to have, say, quality of life, quality relationships with other people. So even myself, I put emphasis on something. I always put emphasis on is say like living one's life skillfully, having quality relationships with other people, like learning as much as you possibly can about the mind, about other people, about the world around you. Because when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, and you have to leave this life, and you really don't know exactly when and where you're going to have to leave this human birth. And especially with the monks, we see it because we're always in contact with families and their circumstances. So we see death, and we see suicide on a regular basis. And the human world is not a very safe or predictable place to be at all. You can lose your life in a finger snap. And I'm not being negative, and I'm not being pessimistic about this. It's just a reality of life. If your karma is up, you're gone. So my attitude is you essentially you do the best you can with what you've got. And I have this kind of mentality of of human beings and even deva beings, even potentially Brahmaloka beings, you know, like developing one's parami, developing one's qualities. And, you know, because my brother and I, we were fruit picking years ago. I won't sidetrack too much. It's just an example. We were picking garlic and asparagus and onion. You know, we're at central New South Wales, this and that. We met a gentleman who had been working on farms for years and years, and cruising around with an old pickup truck, and been drinking heavily for years and for years, and was brain damaged. And he liked the lifestyle. He made enough money to live. And the last memory my brother and I had of him when we left Edgells in Cowra was Norm's ute halfway off this country highway, half on, half off. Norm completely passed out over the steering wheel, and we knew he had a cardiac arrest previously. And I said to my brother, because we were leaving to go leaving to go home, and I wouldn't do this if I was a monk, but I said to my brother, well, maybe he had a heart attack, and he's either dead or he's dying. And my God knows why. My brother said, he said, we've got to be in Wollongong tomorrow at a certain time. We had an appointment. We had to meet people. And if we'd got caught up, unfortunately, I'm not being, I'm not being, being callous, but my brother made the point that he said, look, we just don't have time to look after this guy. Maybe get an ambulance and the police, and then hang around. Maybe we'll have to stick around for maybe 3, 4, 5 hours, and providing the police with details and going to the hospital and all this kind of stuff. And in the end, I just checked him. He was still breathing. I checked him as we passed. He was still breathing, but essentially he was almost like half unconscious through with alcohol consumption. So there's a person who he's probably quite he's a decent human being. He's worthy of respect. He's worthy of recognition and support to a degree. I mean, if I was a practicing Buddhist, if I was a monk, I would have, and if I wasn't sort of stuck for time, I definitely would have looked after and watched over him until he recovered. But the thing is, there's a person whose potential has gone to waste to a significant degree. So, you're 60, maybe 61 years of age, and you're obviously brain damaged. Your brain, your memory, all these faculties which deteriorate with excessive alcohol consumption. That's the case, and so in essence, you're going to die. Maybe out in the field, somewhere, which is not such a bad thing. I mean, I've got a friend of mine who's 95 years of age. He hasn't got much time left, and he loves to garden. He's got his front and back garden are like a jungle. He's out there every day, absolute minimum, 1 to 2 hours at least every single day, and he lives for his garden. He told me himself, if it wasn't for the garden, he'd be dead already. So, he's got cardiac respiratory insufficiency. So when he gets exhausted, he just lays down amongst the flowers, the roses and the pansies and the daffodils, whatever stuff he's got going. And he just lays down amongst the flowers and goes to sleep. When he wakes up, then he just kicks into action, and then he just keeps going. And so his nephew, who's a very, quite a caring person, very, very intelligent fellow, was looking after a organization within the mental health fraternity in Wollongong. Very capable guy, very smart, and very well educated. All he does is he doesn't touch him. He just makes sure that he's still breathing, and he just leaves him alone. Because even when he stops breathing, he won't touch him. He won't get an ambulance, and he won't ring anyone until he's completely gone. Until he's absolutely sure that he's left his physical body. Because the greatest service he could ever give him is to, or the greatest thing he could ever do for him is to allow him to die with his head touching the earth, you know, amongst the flowers that he has grown and cultivated for the last 40 to 50 years. And, you know, it's a fantastic way to die. And myself, I mean, you know, to die under like a beautiful big tree or out in nature, or even to be taken out by maybe a big brown snake or a red-bellied black. I mean, I really wouldn't mind, you know, as long as I'm not screaming in pain, because there are snakes where, you know, you'd rather be dead than have these guys bite you. But if you keep yourself very, very calm, and you know, you don't panic. I mean, you know, not to say that it's not going to be painful, and you know, the symptoms are going to be very, very significant. But you just, hopefully, you just try to relax and just, you know, just hold yourself together, and hopefully you might sort of slip into a nice peaceful coma and die. And I wouldn't mind, as long as I'm not screaming in pain. I'd be more than happy to do that. So, you know, so when you look at the, you know, what the Buddha was trying to teach us, so the foundation principles of the path, you know, sila, whether it's monastic sila, whether it's the five precepts for the lay disciples, the development of meditation, the development of wisdom, which is a key principle for everyone. Doesn't matter how simple you are, how smart you are, you know, how, you know, the difference in the faculties. Every single one of you, including the Christians, including the Muslims and the Hindus, as human beings on this earth, have a responsibility to die much wiser than the day you were born. So if you live for 60, 70, 80, 90 years of age, and you haven't developed any wisdom whatsoever, well, I mean, I really feel very sorry for it, because you've just wasted a significant period of your life. But you know, many, many, many people, they have a tangible feel for this kind of mindset. You know, probably half the population, you know, have the big question, what is the meaning of life, and why am I here? You know, my a good friend of mine, a guy he was working with, the chef in the kitchen at the retirement facility down the coast from where he lives, one day just puts down his washcloth and the scrubbing brush. And he says, Kenny, he said, what is this life all about? You know, what is it really about? You know, I've got my wife, and I've got something like four or five children. And, you know, the guy, just in that moment, he had this, like, being this big question, like the, what would you call it? Like, not quite the same, but, you know, that moment of Zen, you know, where that big riddle, that big question comes up in your mind, and, you know, what is the nature of life and the universe? So, you know, so he was I wouldn't call it a midlife crisis. He was, late 40s, you know, wife and children and a mortgage, and, you know, just the standard stuff that many, many people do. in general society, but you know, it was life. It was like he was reflecting on his life, and he was wondering, like, where am I? You know, what am I doing? And you know, where is my life going? Is this what it, how can I explain? Is this going to be as good as it gets? And I've had a number of people actually say this, but most of them are practitioners, and they have that sensitivity, and they have that emotional, that intuitive, kind of sensitivity, where they're looking at life and they're thinking, you know, like marriage and children, you know, the boyfriend, girlfriend, you know, the world traveler, you know, using every single drug under the sun. You know, where, you know, I mean, is this as good as it's going to get within this human experience? And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying, because what I'm doing is I'm bouncing things off you. What I'm saying is that some people feel, and this is what I feel as well, that I mean, you know, I did, I probably, you know, I did quite a few things in lay life, you know, say significant, meaningful things, and but it really didn't, you know, within my perspective, really didn't amount to that much. And some people, you know, felt, you know, quite similar to myself, but it's a matter of insight. You get this sense of you know, the five sense experience has a workable limit. You know, you can have, I'm not being weird or strange when I say this, but no matter what experience you can get through this body, the most incredible sex, the most incredible drugs, the most incredible, maybe insight might be slightly, it might be something quite amazing, but you know, there are limits to how far this body can take you. You know, there's a workable limit what you can do with this body. And how good you can feel, or how incredible, you know, I mean, the most incredible drugs, the mo you know, most incredible interpersonal experience with another person. Not to, like, I don't underestimate these things, because they may be very meaningful, and they may bring you to a sense of like deep understanding if you use it in that way. You know, if you go through some incredible experience and you don't actually reflect on it, you don't like really take it in and assimilate it and absorb it and make sense of it, well, it might be, you know, like it might be a waste of a significant experience in one's life. You know, it's like when people, you know, when people absolutely lose themselves. They absolutely lose themselves in another person. And you know, say the most ultimate love experience that you have, and you lose your own sense of self. You're so enraptured, and with this other person, you're so absorbed in this other person that your sense of self just seems to disappear. You just live for this individual. You just feel at one. You know, you're just one pointed on this person. And my friend, my Christian friend, said just that. You know, he it took a little while for him to really to take a shine to this young lady, but you know, he was a little bit more gentle on the uptake, you know, being a you know, very, very moral Christian young man. And this girl had about four or five brothers, so you know, she understands guys and men very, very well. But in essence, He was just thinking about her day and night, when they first got to together, and he just, his own self identity, his own sort of personality just seemed to evaporate when he was enraptured with this person. And it's like losing yourself. One loses oneself in this connection with another human being, which might be quite useful, this sense of the egolessness, which people can, they might get this thing when they're maybe climbing a mountain or hang gliding or going caving, the deepest caves on the earth, really amazing, sharp, focused, present moment experiences where you get that sense of oneness. You lose that sense of personal identity. So getting back, the Buddhist path, one has to feel one's way with the 37 enlightenment factors, with sila, with meditation, with the wisdom faculty. The insight and wisdom cannot arise in the, say, like a general practitioner, whether it's lay or monastic, without, and say, like an emotional tone. You have to feel in order to understand. When you have very, very profound meditation, your emotions, the feelings you have, are incredibly subtle. Sometimes you may not even be able to see them at all, because you have the mind is so still and it's so clear and it's so pure. You don't have the normal human emotions that other people have. Your mind is so pure and so clean. You're just functioning and perceiving on a much more refined level. And this is what gives you the clarity, the sharpness, the ability to see things very, very deeply, like a laser beam, because your personality is you're not perceiving things through your personality. You're perceiving things through with this very clear, bright mind, which is like a laser. It really sees things very deeply and very accurately, because your personality cannot do that. Can only do that to a very small degree. That's why we spend years and years and years developing insight and developing meditation, where you get the jhanas, where you get this incredibly, this one point, like real one pointedness, not just like, oh, my mind is so concentrated. Not like this. It's absolutely solid, like a rock. It's immovable, and it's very, without excessive detail, very, 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 very profound. And when you come out of that state, then you have the potential to really see and understand things to a very profound level. So, to wrap things up, with one's personal experience, that the more that you take in, the more emotions you go through, the more experiences you go through, the raw material for your insight practice. And just because, some maybe small trivial thing comes up, you shouldn't just, just sort of, what's the right word to, can think that it's not even worth your consideration or contemplation, because, you've got this massive, your life, your insight knowledge is like a massive jigsaw puzzle, maybe 10 times the size of this room, or maybe exaggerating, but You're trying to put the pieces together. So you're over there in a corner, and you know, you've got maybe four or five insights into a particular experience. So you're over there in the corner with four or five pieces, and then you couldn't see anything in the beginning, one or two or three pieces. I still can't really see what's going on. But once you've got five or six or seven pieces, then you start to get a tangible sense for whatever it is that you're going through. You can't fathom the big picture. You still can't see the big picture because it's just too incredible and it's too expansive and it's 10 times the size of this room. But say, for example, you had a handful of jigsaw pieces, and you know, you had something which was maybe, I don't know, maybe 300, you know, maybe a foot by 1 foot, and then you can see something. It could be anything. It could be a shape. It could be a form. It could be an event, and it's tangible, and you can work with it. It's not just rubbish. You know, you have an understanding what it is, even though it's only just a tiny little corner in this massive, massive jigsaw puzzle that you're trying to understand and comprehend. So in essence, you know, to wrap this talk up is your feelings and your relationships and your life experiences are the data. You know, they are the things which you should contemplate and investigate over and over again, because even if the meditation is not fantastic, even if you don't, you know, you don't feel that you're incredibly peaceful, you know, your wisdom faculty, of all your faculties, your wisdom, your insight potentially has the greatest level of power and influence over your parami, over the 37 bojangas, the 37 enlightenment factors, over the Eightfold Path. Your insight practice, wisdom, vipassana, will be at the peak of the period. So of the pyramid. So all those other foundation principles that you're looking at are moving towards the pinnacle, that one point, that single point, which is your understanding the ultimate nature of life. That's what if you have any real, say, responsibility as a human being within this universe, this cosmos, you know, that's exactly what you should be doing. Okay, so I'll open the floor to questions. Hopefully hard, difficult, tough questions. That's the ones I like. I like to, it's not like, not that difficult to sweat on an evening like this, but I don't mind sweating just a little. Okay, Frederick Stewart from USA. What is the Buddhist perspective of violence in the USA? Pro-Trump supporters at Capitol Building and BLM supporters in major cities. Somebody mentioned that yesterday morning, and he was talking about the words that he used. What do they call it when you have people out on the streets in tens of thousands, like at war with the police and what do they call it? Was it with those guys the National Guard? You know, tens of thousands of people fighting the army and the National Guard, and and whatnot. And but the thing is, I mean, yeah, I mean, like violence. Oh, it's a tricky one. It's just so complicated. But within the Buddhist understanding, violence is not the way. It's not the way. And because people get hurt, they get shot. It's not just the USA. You've only got to look around the world, the Middle East, Central America, and you just see how bad it can get. This is only, I'm only guessing. I'm no expert on these things whatsoever. But I mean, from what I hear, those 1,000 people who moved into the Capitol building, supposedly none of those people were shot, from what was said, and they were smart enough not to be armed, because the security staff probably would have shot them for sure. The National Guard and the soldiers would have shot them as soon as they saw, these guys start pulling out guns. It's going to get serious. But yeah, but the bottom line is, within the Buddhist perspective, violence is not the way. It just makes things worse. It makes people angry. It makes them revengeful. It makes other people hate you, and they want to basically get you and fix you and do you in. But Mr. Trump, then again, like I'm not an expert on these matters, but Mr. Trump's approach to, even though he's a smart guy in certain ways, but not others. He's just really, he's I mean, he's really like sort of really, really stirring the hornet's nest on this one, and it just seems to be getting more intense and more troublesome and more difficult. And it's not the right way to go. If I was Mr. Trump, I would just bow out gracefully. It doesn't matter how what Mr. Trump may feel. He's been robbed, and he needs so many more votes to hold the presidency. But from my perspective, the thing with Mr. Trump is this man wants power, and he wants authority, and he wants to kick people's butts. And all the stuff that you guys already know. I don't have I'm not in the news on very often. I don't have a phone with the internet. But just very, very egocentric behavior. And so I'm very happy that Mr. What's his name? Mr. Biden will be coming into power very, very shortly. And there's going to be he's going to perform. He doesn't have any choice. He's got very, very smart, intelligent, capable people on his team, and hopefully he will save the American economy and save the American people. Anyway, so Wolfgang Guis from Germany, can you find peace and calm down if you constantly have to calm down the irritations in your body due to chronic pain and breathing problems? What is a feeling but me? It's a matter of skillfulness. So, for example, you've got chronic pain. Even if you have to lie on the floor, even if you have to lie on a bed of fluffy pillows, it's a good thing to do if it brings you a sense of ease and comfort. But even then, even on the most incredible mattress, the most incredible fluffy pillows, you still may be this chronic pain will not stop. And naturally, you have professionals who are trained in this area. There are certain meditations which are more effective than others. There are ways of, say, relaxing the physical body. Sometimes chronic pain can come from excessive tension. Maybe excessive tension with muscles, ligaments, tendons. Maybe one worries too much, and one feels physically, emotionally tight. There are professionals who are experts in this area, but this feeling is me. This is me. But your mind is one thing and your body is another. But we are attached to this physical body. So when my body hurts, I'm going to worry and feel anxiety and maybe get a bit uptight and this and that. So the bottom line is you've got to find the right meditation, which helps to bring you a sense of ease and calm. The best meditation that you know of, practice with different techniques, and you have these people who are experts in pain management and sort of working with a body which has chronic, like pain over time. And you've got to use your insight knowledge. If I've got a painful, my body's in pain and I'm really, really anxious and this and that. You've got to understand what you're going through, because I keep reacting again and again and again with fear and anxiety and worry and tension. I keep, that one's mind keeps reacting to the discomforts of this physical body. So you really need to understand what you're going through in order to let this stuff go, at least to a small degree. Baba from Germany. Hi, Achanapi. Could you please speak a little about the island or ocean of joy on the Buddhist map? Where is it, and what is your way of traveling to that place? Thank you. The island of joy within the Buddhist perspective. So what happens is, when you start to get quite good with the meditation, when you start to get a degree of stillness, like rapture, piti, you have five levels of rapture that you can feel through, through the body, through the mind. And when you reach that point, the way it feels is when you reach a point in your mind where your mind starts to converge, when your mind really starts to get concentrated. So say, for example, you've been meditating for years on end, but the meditation, it's still not firm. It's still not focused. It's still, the meditation is still a little bit fluffy. It's a little bit light and fluffy. But once the meditation starts to come together, and there's a sense of, you can feel a sense of firmness, oneness, the one's mental faculties are coming together, then you should see piti. This is like a law in the mind itself. This is a mind experience. That one's mental energy start to focus, start to come together, and one starts to move towards oneness, and that's when the joy will start to manifest in one's mind. That's when you'll feel it, a sense of rapture, energy, joy. I mean, I've had, this is well short of a samadhi nimitta, but I've had strong rapture. I mean, God knows where it comes from. Running, it's almost like a kundalini experience, because the rapture, it just flows and runs through the physical body, through the whole physical body, into the mind, up to 5 hours. And you think to yourself, where is it coming from? So in essence, these things, when the conditions are supportive, you can get this kind of experience. And the Tai Chi, the Qi Kung, or the, what would you call it? What do they call it? The Kundalini Yoga people, practitioners, the meditators, they may call this thing just that, the awakening of the Kundalini, because the energy just flows and flows and flows, for hours. And the Qi people might call it like the opening of the meridians, and you're getting the energy of the universe flowing through you. To give you an idea what can happen, I was meditating late, not incredibly late, maybe about midnight, and just after midnight. And then I knew I had to get like 5 hours before I went up for breakfast, otherwise I'd get a little bit laggy. And because all sorts of stuff you have to do. So what happened was, I kept meditating right to the point that I dropped off to sleep. And then probably about, so I'm only guessing roughly, maybe, I don't know, who knows, quarter past 12, half past 12 in the morning, I was asleep. But something happened in my mind. And I was woken up at about 3 o'clock in the morning with this massive surge of energy, and that previous experience was pretty mild by comparison. And what it felt, this second experience, what it felt was the whole universe. It was like being plugged into the universe. The energy of the universe was just running through you. So it started at the soles of my feet. So, you know, this thing is pretty strong. So you're instantly awake. And this thing takes about maybe 7 seconds. 1, 2, 3. Give it 7 seconds, a bit more, 7 or 8. From the soles of the feet, it's moving up the body. It's moving up the spine. You can feel it right through the body, but it's concentrated. It's concentrated in the spinal column, and it's moving up. And then when it hits your mind explodes into light. And but you know, that's well short. You know, that's well short of a like a full samadhi, upachara samadhi experience. Is still short of that. But the energy, you know, you're just looking at 7 to 8 seconds, and there's so much energy there that you can't sleep. So if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you think to yourself, oh my God, I'm just absolutely, you know, my eyes are almost popping out of my head. I felt like I've slept all night long, and then you just sit for 3 hours straight, effortlessly. And I thought to myself, well, it's 6 a.m., I've got to go up for breakfast at 6:30, and then I have to, you know, I'm on Dhanasala, I have to clean, I have to upataka, I have to do all these different things. And so I need, you know, I need like 3 hours, 3 hours sleep. And then I just tidied everything up, cleaned up the kuti, went up. And then I worked, and then I had to do a few other little bits and pieces. And I went back to my kuti, so I had 3 hours sleep. So you do the morning's work, you do bits and pieces, and you're still not tired. You still don't need to have a nap, and then you go right through till late evening, till maybe 11:30, like 11:30 p.m. or a little bit later, and then you have to get some sleep. You've had 3 hours. But then you can still go through to 11:30. So it's quite interesting how much energy you can generate in a very, very short space of time when the conditions are right. So, you know, this kind of thing is very, very useful. You can reflect on this kind of thing in relation with samadhi and vipassana and kundalini, all this other stuff. It's very, very useful to reflect on. Was there any personal questions with the audience here at all? Okay, so we'll wrap. Thank you for your kind attention. We'll wrap everything up and finish.